You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at video games, violence, and aggressive behavior, and hear about the latest psychological research. First, the proposed Back 40 mine would produce gold and other resources in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, right across the river from Wisconsin. Recently reported documents show that the state of Michigan signed off on the project even though environmental regulators had concerns about Aquila Resources' permit application. The Toronto-based company wants to mine gold, zinc, and other metals near the Menominee River. It's about 35 miles upstream from Marinette. But the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, whose reservation is two counties away from the proposed site, is trying to keep that from happening. Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior. Danny, good to have you back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, give us some background on this Back 40 mine. What's the proposal here?
Yeah, so Canadian company Aquila Resources plans to build a mine to mine gold, zinc, and copper, and that would be at times within 150 feet of the river in the western Upper Peninsula on the Michigan-Wisconsin border. And so it would be an open-pit sulfide mine. It would operate on about 83 acres, and it would be about 750 feet deep. And it would provide millions of pounds of zinc, copper, lead, and silver, and in addition to gold.
And as with a lot of mines, there's been some controversy here. We'll talk about some of the challenges. But first, what are we finding in this release of documents from Michigan's environmental regulators?
So the documents from the Water Resources Division with the then Department of Environmental Quality in Michigan showed that regulators or staff had significant concerns about the information that was being submitted by the company on wetlands and water quality. Basically, they were saying that they had insufficient or incorrect information from mine consultants to assess the impacts of groundwater and wetland modeling. So they don't really feel like they got a good idea of what the impacts would be. The mine consultants made changes on numerous occasions without consulting with the department on those changes. And that really resulted in inaccurate information being presented to regulators as far as what the impacts to wetlands and water quality would be from the proposed mining operation, whether it's during operation or throughout the life of the mine and once it's done.
Despite those concerns that we've learned about from regulators, the state of Michigan ultimately approved this permit. What do we know about what they said in the approval process?
Yeah, so the state of Michigan issued the final wetlands permit last June. And this final wetlands permit basically had conditions. They had to meet a number of data collection points where they had to have baseline groundwater and wetland data before they could start construction of the mine. And basically, opponents to the project are saying that's information that should have been worked out with regulators before any kind of permit was awarded. Because basically, they're saying that the mining company is saying, well, just trust us. We're going to give you this information and everything's going to work out fine. But as the documents have shown, there's some reservations with staff about their ability to provide that information and do so correctly.
Ultimately, the Environmental Protection Agency, did they at the federal level get involved in approving this?
Yes, they did. And that was one point that the tribe, the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin, wanted to see was the EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers handle permitting of this project because they're a sovereign nation. So they feel that under their treaty rights, they should have dealt with federal authorities on this. But that didn't happen because the EPA had already granted permitting authority to Michigan. And that's been a sticking point because the tribe has said that they were not consulted on this project as a result of that. And that's a requirement under federal laws, but not under state laws, as far as I know. And so basically, it's caused some problems. The EPA objected to the wetlands permit at first, but then a few months later, they agreed with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality that yes, they could issue the permit with conditions.
Talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading about the Back 40 mine. It's in Michigan, on the Michigan side of the Wisconsin-Michigan border by the Menominee River. Are there legal challenges? Are there court challenges going on right now, Danny?
Yeah, so after this final wetlands permit was awarded, the tribe initiated a lawsuit against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So they sued them, and basically that lawsuit was dismissed by a lower court. Now they're appealing that in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and they're also appealing it at the state level. So they're trying to use whatever legal avenues they have to get the kind of representation that they wanted to see in the first place throughout this permitting process.
Danny, can you talk a little more about why the Menominee tribe is particularly interested in this mine?
Yeah, so the Menominee Indian tribe is very tied to the Menominee River. You know, they can trace their creation story and history back to the river, and there are culturally significant sites there, including burial mounds with remains of tribal ancestors that are up and down the Menominee River. So it's something that they're very concerned about, being able to preserve that piece of their culture and their history.
What has the company itself, Aquila Resources, said about environmental concerns raised about this mine?
Yeah, so Aquila has said that this has been through a really rigorous process by the state, that they have permits that contain stringent conditions that ensure that the mine will operate with minimal impacts to the environment and surrounding waters. And they say that they stand behind the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, which is now the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. So they believe that regulators made the best decision.
Now, we're here in Wisconsin talking about this. The Menominee tribe is involved. Also, the Menominee River flows out ultimately into past Marinette and Menominee, right? So there's a Wisconsin side to this story.
Right, yeah. The Menominee River drains into Green Bay and there into the Great Lakes. So this has been a really big issue for environmentalists and the tribe in the area.
So we're watching this in the courts now. What are we looking at as far as next steps for the development of the Back 40 mine?
So as far as the next steps, my understanding is that they're currently going through all the baseline data collection that was required. And they, I mean, Aquila Resources, is working with regulators on collecting that information on groundwater and impacts to wetlands to make the models more accurate to get a better idea of the impacts there. And also on the legal side of things, it looks like they're set to hear oral arguments in federal appeals court next month. So we'll see what the federal court panel has to say about that.
Danny, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks, Rob.
Danielle Kading is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Superior. We talked with her about the latest on the proposed Back 40 mine in Michigan's Upper Peninsula near the Wisconsin border. Coming up, if you like strong magnets and searching for treasure at the bottom of a body of water, we have a new hobby for you. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about a new hobby that combines fishing and magnets, but not how you might think. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on a celebration that took place this month.
While communities across the country celebrate Pride in June, Madison's festivities take place in August. This year's event harkens back to one of the first LGBTQ celebrations in the city. Alex Peake tells us more about Pride and the Magic Festival.
From drag queens to food trucks to high heel races, Madison is introducing a new Pride celebration in the form of Outreach's Magic Festival. Sammy Schock, who identifies as a fat, black, queer, cisgender, non-disabled woman, is the festival's organizer. She talks about how they decided to make the switch from parade to party.
The parade, often, you know, lots of folks would come and you would walk down State Street and you get that beautiful view of like all the rainbow flags walking towards the state capitol. It's a beautiful image. But after that, people would disperse.
The switch is also a way to heal rifts from last year's controversy about police presence in the parade.
For me, it is to move away from the reliance on cops. I do not personally want to see the queer community embrace systems that are harming people within our own community.
Schalk hopes the changes make this year's festival a safe space for everyone in the community.
But I really hope that it's a place that people get excited about, that they like plan their outfits for in advance, like they're ready to come and like show up and show out at this event. I hope that it becomes a place that is very friendly for queer youth to see each other, to see adult queer role models. It really means that we get to see the diversity of folks who identify as Quilt Bang is the most recent one that I saw. So like queer, undecided, intersex, lesbian, trans, bisexual, asexual, aromantic, non-binary gay. Quilt Bang. You're welcome.
This year's Pride marks the 30th year anniversary of Madison's first Pride March, as well as the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots that cemented the gay pride movement. The Magic Festival also has roots in a historical Madison Pride celebration called the Magic Picnic.
Happy magic to you!
As Pride marches gained momentum across the nation, Richard Kilmer was shocked Madison didn't have its own Pride parade. With the help of two of his friends, Kilmer organized Madison's first march in 1989.
Well, I was working with Madison AIDS Support Network. It was during the AIDS crisis, and a friend of mine had gone to the 1987 Second March on Washington, 750,000 people. He came back, and he was very energized, and I said, oh, I have another friend who's very energized. Maybe we should all get together and have a march here. It was very empowering. Lots of people watching from the sidelines who were afraid to march, who came up to me years later and said, that was my defining moment when I saw all those people. And I was afraid to march, but it caused me to come out. I mean, I think it started out as a march for civil rights, and now it seems to become more of a celebration. I think it's become important again to be active and to be vocal and for people to know that we're there.
Whether it's a celebration or a fight for equality, Schalk makes it clear that Pride exists to make space for those to love and live freely.
The point of it is to celebrate us, to fight for our right to exist in the world as we are, to love the people that we love, to be who we are. We're in a different moment than we were 30 years ago, and we have to figure out how to be part of this community in this particular moment.
This story came to us from Alex Peak, a recent graduate of Madison East High School. She'll be attending film school in Chicago in the fall. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every episode of Wisconsin Life? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, there's a new hobby game gaining some steam in Wisconsin and around the world, magnet fishing. It involves people tying super strong magnets to long ropes and fishing for objects at the bottom of rivers and lakes. Sometimes people find trash, other times they'll reel in some interesting stuff. Jim Walters is a magnet fishing enthusiast and operator of Magnet Fishing Wisco. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Happy to be here.
Well, now, magnet fishing, the name deceived me a little. Nothing to do with actual fish, right?
No, nothing to do with actual, you know, fishing that we do here in Wisconsin with bait and a hook. Yeah.
Now, how did you first run across this idea of fishing for metal stuff that's hidden underwater?
You know, I kind of got a metal detector for Christmas one year and was on YouTube trying to figure out how this contraption worked. And then I kind of came across a common thread of this magnet fishing hobby, which kind of stemmed from over in Europe, catching things in the canals and the riverways. And I was on YouTube for hours and hours watching these guys pull metal with these ropes and this weird looking hockey puck shaped magnet And I was kind of hooked. I was kind of hooked at that point. So,
what kind of things have you caught when you've been out magnet fishing in Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin's a little bit different. You know, we a lot of people are catching war artifacts and this and that. And here in Wisconsin, a lot of it is things left over from fishing, dropped knives, dropped fishing poles, pliers. The other thing we're finding a lot of is bikes, razor scooters, anything that's not nailed down, maybe in a park that usually gets tossed in, you know, garbage cans and benches. I've come across some interesting finds in certain areas. A couple guns here and there, a lot of signs. Pretty much anything you can think of that might be either hidden, tossed, you know, or dropped accidentally. So
let's talk about these magnets here. This isn't our everyday refrigerator magnet, right?
No, they are actually neodymium magnets. So what that means is they are usually high power. They have a pretty good lift. They range in anywhere on the internet from, say, 300 pound lift to 1200, 1500 pound lift.
Wow. Okay. What's the biggest thing? What's the heaviest thing you've snagged with one of these magnets?
I think the heaviest thing I've gotten was probably a cast iron sign from a bridge builder. From the early 1900s, they used to weld on their plaques on these bridges. A company out of Chicago, 1900, the Lassig Bridge and Steel Company. So I latched onto this thing, and there was a big click on the line, and I realized, oh, this is a little bit bigger than your typical stuff. So I got my brother and my teenage son, and we yanked that thing out of there, and I judge it was probably about 110, 120 pounds. So,
what do you do with all the stuff when you bring it up?
Well, I would say 90% of what we bring up is usually garbage. A lot of it is, say, fishing line, hooks, tin cans. A lot of it we go ahead and properly dispose of. I would say maybe about 10% is actual items that maybe we could clean up and repurpose. And a little bit of that amount is stuff we could actually clean up, maybe soak, and then wire brush and clean. And maybe we could actually sell some of that stuff. So we've come across some items, and it's definitely not a treasure hunting, money making hobby as of yet.
So. Now you're trying to encourage other people in Wisconsin to do this. And one of your big messages, it seems like, is clean up after yourself. Don't leave the stuff on the shore. Don't throw it back in the water after you find it.
Right. And then that's kind of been a problem. I think over in Europe, we're seeing a lot of posts with everyone's kind of jumping on board with this new hobby. And what comes with that is I think people who really want to get that, those treasure items, those key items, and everything they bring up, a lot of people have been just leaving on the shores, along the canals. And kind of like we discussed, some friends that are involved in magnet fishing, now they are enacting ordinances and laws and some signage to kind of keep the hobby at bay because of the mess. So we always encourage whatever you bring up, it definitely doesn't belong there, and properly dispose of.
You know, you've got these big, powerful magnets. How do you handle that around other metal stuff in your life?
Well, I always stress safety and caution. These magnets are very powerful, and if fingers or any parts of your body get caught between the magnet and a large piece of metal, it's going to have disastrous consequences. So I always have mine in a large kind of a couple buckets, and I also have a couple boxes that are kind of sealed up a little bit. So that's how we transfer them. We're very careful, especially when you're out there and you're all excited and you're tossing your magnet in. You always have to be aware of all the large metal around you. So, I've gotten stuck on bridges and I've gotten stuck on all sorts of things. And sometimes you just have to cut the rope. Sometimes you just have to say goodbye. So, always exercise caution with these high-powered magnets, for sure.
If somebody's out there listening, Jim, and thinking, yeah, this sounds cool, I want to try some magnet fishing, how do you suggest they get started?
How I would get started is do a little bit of legwork, do a little bit of research, get on some of these threads, some of these Reddit threads, some of these YouTube videos, kind of read the reviews. With the popularity of the hobby, now comes kind of cheap knockoffs, and everyone's kind of rushing to have their own magnet for sale and their own. So I would definitely read the reviews, use the internet, and Amazon has magnets for sale, neodymium magnets, and eBay and certain vendors online. So definitely get out there, do some education, and really, do your research, what works best, and ask your fellow magnet fishermen. You know, ask what works, what not can I use, and, so you're kind of off and running at that point. So,
and do you have a next excursion planned, Jim?
I'm kind of plotting out. So I use Google Maps, and I do a lot of historical research here in Wisconsin. And I'm kind of plotting out, I don't mind giving away the location, I'm plotting out Green Bay. Up in Green Bay, a lot of bridges, a lot of waterways, a lot of opportunity for things tossed in. And so we're kind of plotting out kind of a two-day, three-day thing up in Green Bay.
Happy fishing, Jim. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Jim Walters is a magnet fisher from West Bend and the moderator of Magnet Fishing Wisco. He joined us today to talk about magnet fishing and some of his best finds. Coming up, video games are again getting blamed for gun violence and mass shootings in the United States. A researcher on video games and violence shares the latest science on the topic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:15 on The Morning Show, Wisconsin is a big state for cranberries. Join Kate Archer Kent and her guest for a look at the state's cranberry economy and how we got to be number one in the nation. It's tomorrow morning at 7:15 here on the Ideas Network. Now,
we must stop the glorification of violence in our society. This includes the gruesome and grisly video games that are now commonplace. It is too easy today for troubled youth to surround themselves with a culture that celebrates violence. We must stop or substantially reduce this, and it has to begin immediately.
It's President Trump talking to the nation just after the mass shootings that took place in El Paso and Dayton. Politicians have often called out violent video games after mass shootings in the United States. While there are some psychological researchers who argue against a link between violent video games and real-life violence, our next guest says a lot of other researchers have found evidence that links aggression and the playing of video games. Raul Huseman is the Amos Tversky Collegiate Professor of Communication Studies and Psychology at the University of Michigan. He's also a research professor and director of Michigan's Aggression Research Program. Raul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
Well, we heard the president there making a pretty strong correlation between violent video games and real-life violence. As a researcher, how do you and your colleagues try to figure out what, if any, connection there is?
Well, actually, there's been a lot of research for over 50 years looking at media violence in general. Before video games, people were looking at TV violence, movie violence, and then video game violence. And the vast majority of the studies find a relation such that kids who are habitually exposed to more media violence as they're growing up behave more aggressively when they're grown up. Now, that's not to say that the violence in the media is responsible for mass shootings. And too often, the two theories are presented as opposites. Either we control the guns that were have a profusion of guns in the society, or we control the media violence. We need to control both. No matter what effects media violence is having, if youth could not easily have access to guns, they wouldn't be shooting somebody.
Do we tend to oversimplify when we're trying to sort out the link between media violence and real-world actual violence?
Yes, we definitely tend to oversimplify. I think the best way to look at it is violence is really a disease. It's a contagious disease. Youth catch violence from other youth and other adults who behave violently. If you're surrounded by violence in the family, you're more likely to behave violently. If you're surrounded by violence in the community, you're more likely to behave violently. If you're surrounded by violence in your peers, you're more likely to behave violently. And if you're surrounded and exposed to violence habitually in the media, you're more likely to behave violently. It's really just like a contagious disease, except you don't need to be next to the person who's infected with the disease to catch it. You just need to be exposed to them, observe them.
Can you talk about some of the studies that have found increased aggression related to video game violence in particular?
Yeah, well, there's both laboratory studies and longitudinal studies. Now, the thing is, you know, social science research is often imperfect. Public health research is often imperfect. Just like everybody knows people who smoke cigarettes all of their life and have never gotten lung cancer, and people who have lung cancer and have never smoked cigarettes. Some people can play violent video games all their life and never behave particularly violently, and other people behave violently and never play violent video games. But what a number of studies show is that kids who play habitually violent video games later on tend to have a greater propensity to behave violently. And in short term, in the laboratory, we can control various things and have artificial violence and aggression tasks. I mean, the problem is you can't go out in the world and try to do a clinical trial or a test to see if you expose somebody to violence and they'll kill somebody. That would be unethical. So we have these analogous tasks in the laboratory that look at things like behaving aggressively in a game. And those tend to show in the laboratory that playing violent video games tends to cause people to behave more aggressively. And then the real-world studies show that people who report playing violent video games over and over and over and over again grow up to be more aggressive and violent. So we have these two lines of research.
People might point toward a chicken or egg question with the people who like to play a lot of violent video games. Maybe they were inclined to violence before they started playing the video games. Is that something that we're able to sort out?
Not easily, and certainly not in the study in the field. In the laboratory, we can, because we can take people who are equivalent and randomly assign one of them to play a violent video game and the other one to play a nonviolent video game and see which one behaves violently later on. We can do that in the laboratory, but that's just a short-term effect. So we can't do that in the field. So we have to base this on a lot of longitudinal studies which follow kids growing up. I mean, the thing is that we know that kids who are exposed to, for example, neighborhood violence over and over again behave more violently. It would be surprising if media violence did not have the same kind of effect, because as a psychologist, we know that something called observational learning is the process, the psychological process producing the effect. Children see and children do. Imitation is a very, very powerful process in developmental psychology. And it would be hard to believe that children could see certain things in their neighborhood, in their family, in their peers that had an effect, and it wouldn't have an effect if they saw it on the screen. That's just hard to believe.
Dr. Raul Huseman from the University of Michigan, looking at violent video games and real-world aggression and violence, looking at some of the research that tries to connect the dots between the two. Raul, based on what we know now and the research that's out there, what would you say to parents about who are wondering, okay, when is too early for a violent video game? How should we limit kids' behavior? What kind of things should we be thinking about?
Well, first of all, I think no one should misinterpret what researchers are saying that kids should not play video games. Video games are great teachers. There's Mindscape and a lot of games that can be very beneficial. I mean, we use video games to teach all sorts of skills that are very good. The problem is when you're playing violent video games, first-person shooter games and so on, the skills you're learning are skills how to aggress against someone else. So what I would say to parents is encourage your kids to play video games, but not violent video games. Video games that teach things you want your kids to learn. Skills, pro-social behavior, all sorts of things.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jonathan writes, I think there is a link between video games and violence, but Jonathan writes, it's far from the simplistic public discourse so far. We live in a violence-soaked culture where movies, TV, politics, and yes, video games present a cultural menu of sorts to the troubled people who wish to lash out in some way. What do you think, of Raul, of what Jonathan had to say?
Well, I think that's very insightful. I mean, I agreed to a great extent with what he says. The media violence is just one part of a culture of violence, and we have to reduce that. We have to reduce violence in the neighborhoods, in the family, and in the media if we're going to have an effect on reducing violence in society.
On the other hand, we heard from Derek, who says, no, there is no direct link, but in online games, the anonymity of players leads to hostility. I believe that the trend in games and all social media is unhealthy. So Derek doesn't think it's the content, but the disconnect from our fellow humans that we get sometimes when we play games online.
Well, there are a lot of people who have that view, and quite honestly, I think they're just wrong. They have not really looked at the research the way that I have and a lot of other scholars have. The research really shows very compellingly that the more violent video games, the more violent media you're exposed to, the greater the risk of behaving aggressively. But as I said at the start, it's just like cigarette smoking and lung cancer. For some kids, they can play a lot of violent video games and they'll never behave more violently. For other kids, it will be very detrimental.
Talking to Raul Huseman, he's a professor of psychology and communication studies at the University of Michigan. We're talking about violence in video games and whether it leads to real-world aggression or violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the research that's out there into video games and other forms of media violence? What do you think about the connection? If you are a parent, do you think carefully about the kind of video games you let your kids play or the shows, for that matter, that you let them watch? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Raul Huseman, psychology and communication studies professor at the University of Michigan. We're talking about violent video games and whether they can cause aggression and violence in real life. And you can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you play violent video games yourself? Do you let your kids do it or do you restrict them? Call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. We've got Dave with us in Appleton. Dave, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am just curious as to how far this research goes back. If we want to look at actual statistics, violent crime overall has been on a steady decrease for a long time now, regardless of what the media would have us believe. And if violent video games really are the cause of this, I can't imagine what kind of violent video games they were playing in medieval times, like the most violent time in history. So I'm just not sure how this data correlates, really.
Dave, thanks for the call. So violent trend, violent crime trends generally downward, Raul, even amidst the rise of video games.
Well, there's a problem in looking at crime trends and comparing the sales of video games, for example. Yes, if the only cause of violence were video games, you'd expect to find a direct relation. But many things cause violence. Violent video games are just one small part of all the things. So it's not surprising that when sales of violent video games go up, violent crime doesn't go up. It would be like not surprising that there are more sales of beer in Germany than Wisconsin. I'm not sure if that's true.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Yeah, we drink a lot of beer here.
But you know, and we know alcohol produces a propensity to behave aggressively. But just because there are more beer sales and there's less propensity for aggression in Wisconsin, let's say, than Germany, that doesn't mean there's no relation between alcohol and beer sales. That's the problem with looking at these trends. I mean, the fact of the matter is that if you look at individual differences in people, people who are exposed more to violent video games have a greater propensity to behave aggressively in any society. You know, there are many societies that have less violence in the United States, and there are some that have more violence in the United States. But those differences in societies are not going to be explained by differences in playing violent video games. Differences in gun violence are most likely to be explained by differences in the ease in which you can get guns, for example, not in the differences between a number of people playing video games or being exposed to violent media.
Dave, thanks for that call. Go now to Mark with us in Hartford. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question was just if there's an age that you would call like a cutoff time from where you transition a child from playing nonviolent video games to allowing them to play games that say their friends are playing or you know, whatever is popular currently. I know that it's not talked about, I feel like, as often, but there are video games that have the rating system, but of course, you know, young children are, you know, still getting their hands on whatever, you know, Grand Theft Auto just recently came out.
Mark, thanks for the call. Raul, it sounds like in general you'd say we're all better off playing fewer or no violent video games, but how young or what age would you say just don't even go there for a kid?
Yeah, well, this is the way I put it, actually. I mean, I would have trouble advocating anyone playing violent video games, but what research and psychological theory shows is that by the time you're actually probably in your mid-teens or late teens, these scripts for social behavior are so well developed and the norms for social behavior that playing violent video games, being exposed to media violence, or being exposed to violence in the neighborhood is not likely to have as much effect, nearly as much effect as younger kids. So when I'm talking to parents groups, I say, don't really worry about your older teenager. Worry about your 3-year-old, your 4-year-old, your 6-year-old, your 8-year-old, your 10, 11, 12-year-old. That's when personalities are being formed and scripts for social behavior are being developed. That's the age we really need to worry about.
Mark, thanks a lot for calling in with that question. We'll go now to Katie with us in River Falls. Katie, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Katie?
So he's talking about violent video games, but the thing is with all these mass shootings, most of them are people who identify as male. If violent video games cause as much violence as he's talking about, we'd see both males and females being reported for these things. And I'm a gal who plays video games. I haven't heard square one about gals doing this.
Katie, thanks for the call. Raul, do we know much about gender divisions when it comes to the impact of violent video games?
Well, we certainly know a lot about gender divisions in terms of violence. Katie, you're absolutely right. Males are much more likely to commit violence. If you look at murder rates in general, they're much higher for perpetrators of males than females. But this is not explained by video games, differences in playing video games. This is explained by many other differences between the genders, including norms for roles that you're supposed to follow. I don't like the idea of anyone playing violent video games, but the fact is it's more likely to have a deleterious effect probably on males than on females.
Katie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Raul Huseman is with us from the University of Michigan, a psychologist. He researches, among other things, the impact of media violence. We're talking about video games, violent video games, and whether they cause more aggression and maybe even real-world violent behavior. Back to your calls now. Stephanie is with us in Racine. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. First of all, thanks for taking my call. I have been an avid gamer since I was little, since the release of the Nintendo, and so I've kind of been through the gamut of different systems and all that kind of stuff and different types of games. And my question is just kind of what is it that, or what do you classify as violence? Just because there's all different realms, and generally you're battling something or battling another person, or so it's what actually classifies that and would have an effect? And did you do that that kind of comparison in your studies?
Interesting point, Stephanie Sorrell. There could be everything from Mario jumping on a turtle to really realistic war zone type violence. Do those have different levels of impact?
Actually, they do. The more that the person can identify with the avatar, for example, in a game, the greater the effect it's likely to have. If you can really put yourself into the avatar and really identify with it, then it's more likely to have an effect. In terms of the kind of violence, the violence that has the greatest effect is violence where you think you seem to be doing it for a good end. I mean, nobody wants to really be bad. You want to do things for a good end. In a lot of games, you're trying to be a hero and do things heroically. And those, unfortunately, particularly for young kids, are the kinds of effects that are likely to be strongest because they want to be heroic.
Thanks a lot for the call, Stephanie. Raul, I come back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, oversimplification in this debate. I think a lot of times when people start talking about video games and violence, it's all or nothing. Some people say there's no link at all, and some people say it is a prime driver of violence in our society. It sounds like you're looking for a lot more nuance as we research and especially talk about this.
Yes, I really like the infectious disease model that I think I mentioned earlier, that really being exposed to violence, playing a violent video game, seeing violent movies, TV, seeing violent neighbors in your family and so on, each little thing contributes to an infection of violence in you. And some people have great resistance to being infected. Some people are more susceptible to being infected. And a lot of other factors influence that. So if we think about this as this kind of disease, infectious disease model, I think we're better off because just like any other disease, some people can be exposed to diseases and they'll never catch it because they have resistance. Other people, a slight exposure will have an effect. And I think the same is being exposed to violence. It's the same kind of thing.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Raul, do you see a policy solution aimed at what you're talking about, like a public health problem here?
Well, I should mention that I've been doing research a long time. In 1972, I actually testified before Congress as part of a group that the Surgeon General of the United States, then Jesse Seinfeld, had organized. And the Surgeon General concluded then, there comes a time when the evidence is sufficient to warrant action. That time has come. So I think we've known some action should be taken a long time. The question is what? We live in a free society. We don't want censorship. So it's really up to individuals. And the good thing about this is that the effects, I think everyone agrees, are biggest on children. So we really need to have controls that limit children's exposure. Not limit my exposure or your exposure as an adult, but children's exposure. That's what really produces deleterious effects for society, is children adopting the norm that violence is normal, violent behavior is okay. When someone crosses you, you should be violent against them. That's what we have to try to counteract.
Raul, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I really enjoyed it.
That's Raul Huseman, professor of communication studies and psychology at the University of Michigan, joining us for a look at violence and video games. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Governor Tony Evers joins the show to talk about a letter he sent to President Trump raising concerns about the impact of tariffs on Wisconsin farmers and manufacturers. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, communities around the state are taking a closer look at large-scale livestock operations and in some cases creating short-term bans on them. Kate and her guests look at the issue and innovations in dealing with issues of water quality and runoff. It's tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll get you caught up on what's going on at Wisconsin Public Radio, both on the air and behind the scenes. Tune in for this month's edition of Mondays with Mike. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.